need to produce a specific antibody, B cells seek out the instructions for that antibody in their DNA, although the individual lines of instruction are usually mixed in with instructions for other antibodies. They snip away the lines of instruction for other antibodies and sew the rest back together, essentially rewriting their own genetic code and producing a specialized product in the process. This is called VDJ recombination, named after the regions where the genes that are used in this seek, snip, and sew trick are found. This process sounds similar to the cut-and-paste mechanism employed by some jumping genes. But there is one key difference. Instead of a neat connection, VDJ recombination leaves a little loop when it reconnects the remaining strands. Scientists had never seen that loop effect in jumping genes until the Johns Hopkins team found it in the common fly, where a jumping gene called Hermes behaves just like VDJ. Nancy Craig, one of the scientists behind the study, said, "Hermes behaves more like the process used by the immune system to recognize a million different proteins than any previously studied jumping gene. It provides the first real evidence that the genetic processes behind antibody diversity might have evolved from the activity of a jumping gene, likely a close relative of Hermes." Once your body develops antibodies against a specific invader, you always have those antibodies, which often give you a leg up if that invader tries again. Sometimes that even makes you immune to future infections, like most people are after having had measles. But while the mutations that happen in our B cells are ours to keep, we can't pass them on to our children. They're on the somatic side of the Weissman barrier. Babies are born with a very small number of antibodies, and their immune systems have to start in overdrive. That's one of the many reasons breastfeeding is good for babies. Breast milk contains some of the mother's antibodies, which act as a temporary passive vaccination against infections until the baby's immune system is up and running. We're only just beginning to understand the role that transposable elements, jumping genes, play in life and evolution. They clearly play a much bigger role than we've understood to date. Fully one quarter of active, coding human genes show evidence that they've incorporated DNA from jumping genes. Jeff Bach, a professor of molecular biology and genetics at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine, suggests that jumping genes have been remodeling host genomes more than previously realized. These changes were probably frequently disastrous, but occasionally they might have benignly increased genetic variation or even improved survivability or adaptability. Such remodeling probably happened thousands of times during human evolution. We now know that there have been periods of such massive environmental shift, it's hard to imagine random incremental changes providing enough adaptation to let us survive. Prominent evolutionary thinkers Stephen Jay Gould and Niels Eldridge advanced the theory of punctuated equilibrium, the notion that evolution was characterized by a state of general equilibrium punctuated by periods of significant change that were brought about by large environmental shifts. Is it possible that jumping genes helped species adapt their way through these evolutionary exclamation points? You bet. Jumping genes are beginning to look like Mother Nature's version of on-the-fly genetic engineering. The more we understand how they work, the more they may reveal about how our immune systems protect us against disease, and how our very genetic structure responds to environmental stress. This could open up whole new avenues to immunize people against disease, restore compromised immune systems, and even reverse dangerous mutations on a genetic level. Remember all that junk DNA? That's the stuff that we now call non-coding DNA because it doesn't contain the genetic code to build any cells directly. If you're wondering why we would give millions of strands of DNA a piggyback through evolution, you're not alone. That's why scientists called it junk in the first place. But scientists have now begun to decipher the mystery of those non-coding genes. And it was jumping genes that first provided a key. Once the scientific community recognized that jumping genes were real and important. Researchers started to look for them in genomes of all kinds, including humans. Their first surprise was that a large portion of our non-coding DNA is made up of jumping genes, as much as half of it. But the bigger surprise was this. Those jumping genes look an awful lot like a very special type of virus. You heard that right. A huge percentage of human DNA is related to viruses. You may think about viruses every day, at least about how to avoid them, whether it's the computer or the biological variety. But it's probably been a while since you read about one in a biology book, so here's a quick refresher. A virus is a snippet of genetic instructions that cannot move or reproduce on its own. Viruses can only reproduce by infecting a host and then hijacking the host's own cellular machinery. They may replicate themselves thousands of times inside a cell before eventually bursting its walls and moving into new cells. Most scientists don't consider viruses to be alive because they can't reproduce or metabolize on their own. Retroviruses are a very special subset of viruses. In order to understand what makes them so important, it helps to understand how genetic information is used to build cells and, ultimately, organisms. Generally speaking, bodybuilding follows this pathway: DNA to RNA to protein. Think of DNA as a library of master blueprints for a whole town, and all the different cells in your body as different kinds of buildings: schools, municipal buildings, houses, apartment buildings. When an organism needs to build a particular building, it uses a helper enzyme called RNA polymerase to copy the plans for that building onto strands of messenger RNA, or mRNA. The mRNA takes those instructions to the building site and directs construction of whatever building, or protein, is called for. For a long time, scientists thought genetic information flowed in only that one direction, DNA to RNA to protein. The discovery of retroviruses, like HIV, proved that wrong. Retroviruses are made of RNA. Using an enzyme called reverse transcriptase, they transcribe themselves from RNA into DNA. They actually reverse the information flow. It's sort of like the messenger rewriting the master blueprint instead of copying and carrying the plans. The implications of this are huge. Retroviruses can literally change your DNA. The discovery of RNA that could backslide into DNA led to the development of the novel drugs that are the current mainstay in the cocktail therapy used to treat HIV infection. Like a wheel block used by truckers to park their loads, some of these drugs stop the reverse transcriptase enzyme in its tracks. That leaves HIV stuck within the nuclear truck stop, trying to hitch a ride on DNA, but unable to climb on board. Now imagine what happens when a retrovirus or virus writes itself into the DNA of cells in the germline of an organism. That organism's offspring is born with the virus permanently encoded in its DNA. By the way, scientists don't think that HIV breaks through the Weissman barrier and inserts itself into the DNA of eggs or sperm. Instead, they believe infected mothers pass HIV to their babies during birth when there's a significant opportunity for the mother's blood to mingle with the infant's. Usually, of course, as with all mutations, when an organism's offspring is born with DNA that has been changed by a retrovirus in one of its parents' germ cells, that change is probably harmful, so it doesn't last. But if the virus doesn't hurt, or even helps, the offspring's chance to survive and reproduce, that virus may end up a permanent part of the gene pool. If genetic code that originally came from a virus is part of an organism's gene pool, it's pretty hard to say where one ends and the other begins. Virus and organism have become one and the same. Today we know that at least 8% of the human genome is composed of retroviruses and related elements that have found a permanent place in our DNA. They're called HERVs, or human endogenous retroviruses. Scientists are only beginning to uncover the role HERVs play in human health, but they've already found interesting connections. One study showed that a particular HERV may play an important role in the construction of a healthy placenta. Another documented links between HERVs and the skin disorder psoriasis. And those frisky jumping genes? They may very well be descended from viruses too. There are two basic types of jumping genes. The first type are called DNA transposons, and they jump through a cut-and-paste process. The second type, retrotransposons, are copy-and-paste jumpers. It turns out that copy-and-paste jumping genes, retrotransposons, look an awful lot like retroviruses. That makes sense because the mechanism those copy-and-paste genes use to insert themselves in other genes is very similar to the mechanism retroviruses use. First, a retrotransposon copies itself onto RNA like any normal gene. Then, when the RNA reaches the place in the genome the jumper wants to land in, the retrotransposon uses reverse transcriptase to paste itself into the DNA, reversing the normal information flow, just like a retrovirus does. Does that mean retro-jumping genes are descended from retroviruses? Nobody believes in the power of viral marketing like Luis Villarreal does. At least, nobody believes there's anything on earth that's better than a virus at spreading its message, getting into everything, and generally outlasting the competition. Villarreal is the director of the Center for Virus Research at the University of California at Irvine, and he's followed the implications of viral impact on human evolution to the limit. Villarreal gives Salvador Luria, a Nobel Prize-winning microbiologist whose work stretched from the 1940s to the 1980s, credit for the first suggestion that viruses have helped to spark human evolution from the inside, not just the outside. In 1959, Luria wrote that the movement of viruses into genomes had the potential to create the successful genetic patterns that underlie all living cells. Villarreal speculated that this idea didn't catch on very quickly, because people react with a kind of visceral disgust to the suggestion that we've been shaped by parasites. There's a very strong cultural negative response to the concept of a parasite of any kind. The irony is that this is such a crucial creative force. If you want to evolve, you have to be open to being parasitized. In his book, Viruses and the Evolution of Life, published in 2005, Villarreal argues it's high time to take a fresh look at viruses. Villarreal distinguishes familiar deadly parasites like HIV and smallpox from those he calls persisting viruses. Persisting viruses are the viruses that have migrated into our genome over millions of years and may have become our partners in evolution. It seems clear what the viruses get out of a permanent home in our genomic mothership, a free ride through life. But what do we get out of it? Well, viruses are master mutators. They're vast storehouses of genetic possibility, and they can deliver that possibility incredibly fast, mutating as much as a million times faster than we do. To drive home the sheer volume of genetic potential in the viral world, Villarreal often asks people to try to imagine all of the viruses in the world's ocean, 100 nonillion, for those of you who are counting. These little containers of genetic code are microscopic, but if you laid them end to end, they would be 10 million light years long. By tomorrow, most of them will have spawned a new generation. And that's what they've been doing for several billion years. Villarreal calls viruses the ultimate genetic creators, inventing new genes in large numbers, some of which find their way into host lineages following stable viral colonization. Here's how that works for us. Persisting viruses in our genome have as much at stake in our survival and reproduction as we do. Since they're part of our DNA, they've got an evolutionary interest in our success. Over the last few millions of years, perhaps we've given them the ride of their life, and in return they've given us the chance to borrow some code from their huge genetic library. With all that mutating power, they're bound to happen on useful genes far faster than we could without their help. Essentially, this partnership with viruses may have helped us evolve into complex organisms much faster than we would have on our own. The study of jumping genes has produced evidence that bolsters Villarreal's theory. As we've discussed, jumping genes are probably descended from viruses. As it turns out, the more complex an organism is, the more jumping genes it has. Humans and our African primate relatives even share a particular genetic trait that makes it easier for our genomes to do business in the viral marketplace. Our genomes have been modified by one particular retrovirus in a way that makes it easier for us to be infected by other retroviruses. According to Villarreal, this capacity of African primates to support the persistent infection of other viruses may have put our evolution on fast forward by allowing more rapid mutation through exposure to other retroviruses. It's possible that this capacity helped spur our evolution into humans, which means that all that junk DNA may have possibly provided the code for our evolution up and away from our furry cousins, which means that viruses may have infected us with that code, which means infectious design, anybody? Chapter 7. Methyl Madness, Road to the Final Phenotype. One-third of American children are overweight or obese. That's 25 million kids. In the last 30 years, the percentage of obese 2- to 5-year-olds has doubled, and the percentage of obese 6- to 11-year-olds has tripled. A baby girl born in 2000 now has a 40% chance, almost a coin toss, of developing type 2 diabetes, and that's directly related to the huge surge in heavy kids. What's even sadder is that many of these children are showing symptoms of obesity-related illness while they're still kids. One recent study showed that about 60% of obese 5- to 10-year-olds already exhibited at least one major risk factor for heart disease: high cholesterol, high blood pressure, high triglycerides, or high sugar levels. Of those kids, 25% had more than one risk factor. A 2005 report in the New England Journal of Medicine said that the epidemic of childhood obesity is the critical element in a gathering storm that could produce the first modern decline in American life expectancy, dropping life expectancy as much as 5 years. There's no question that gallons of sugary soda, baskets of fatty fries, and too many hours watching television and playing video games instead of after-school sports is a fattening combo. But new research suggests that may not be the whole story. There is emerging evidence that the dietary habits of parents, especially women in the earliest stages of pregnancy, may have an impact on the metabolism of their children. In other words, if you're trying to get pregnant, you really should think twice before you bite that Big Mac, once for your own waistline and once for your potential child's. Before you get the wrong idea, this isn't to suggest some strictly Lamarckian idea that a fat parent is going to have a fat child because the child will inherit the weight problem his or her parent acquired. But this is to say that new research is rapidly changing our understanding of how, when, and whether genes express themselves. That is, how, when, and whether the instructions in a gene are carried out. A series of groundbreaking research over the last 5 years has shown that certain compounds can attach themselves to specific genes and suppress their expression. These compounds act like a genetic light switch, essentially turning off the genes they attach to. And, here's where it gets really interesting, the research shows that environmental factors, like the food we eat or the cigarettes we smoke, can flick the switch on or off. This research is changing the whole field of genetics. It's even launched a subdiscipline called epigenetics. Epigenetics is concerned with the study of how children can inherit and express seemingly new traits from their parents without changes in the underlying DNA. In other words, the instructions are the same, but something else overrides them. Being a gene isn't all that it was cracked up to be anymore. The term epigenetics was coined in the 1940s, but the modern discipline is much younger, barely out of diapers. The first big breakthrough actually occurred in 2003 in the form of a skinny brown mouse. The shocking thing about this skinny brown mouse is that its parents were both fat yellow mice. Actually, they were fat yellow mice from a long line of fat yellow mice. These mice were specifically bred to carry a gene called agouti, which gives them their characteristic pale coat and tendency toward obesity. When a male agouti mouse mates with a female agouti mouse, they have little agouti mouse babies time after time, fat and yellow. Or they did, until they went to Duke, anyway. A team of scientists at Duke University separated a gang of agouti mice into two groups, a control group and a pregnant group. They didn't do anything special with the control group. They fed it a normal diet and let fat yellow Mickeys mate with fat yellow Minnies, who gave birth to fat yellow babies. No surprise there. The mice in the experimental group made it as well, but the expectant mothers in this group got slightly better prenatal care. In addition to their normal diet, they were given vitamin supplements. In fact, they were given a combination of compounds that is a variation on the prenatal vitamins given to pregnant women today: vitamin B12, folic acid, betaine, and choline. The results rocked the genetic world. Fat yellow female mice that had mated with fat yellow male mice had thin brown babies. That seemed to throw everything the scientific community understood about heredity up in the air. A genetic examination of the brown baby mice only added to the mystery. Their genes were the same as their parents. The agouti gene in the thin brown mice was right where it was supposed to be, ready to send out instructions to make them fat and yellow. So what happened? Essentially, one or more of the compounds in the vitamin supplements fed to the expectant mothers reached down into the mouse embryos and flicked the agouti gene into the off position. When the baby mice were born, their DNA still contained the agouti gene, but it wasn't expressed. Chemicals had attached to the gene and suppressed its instructions. This process of genetic suppression is called DNA methylation. Methylation occurs when a compound called a methyl group binds to a gene and changes the way that gene expresses itself without actually changing the DNA. The compounds in the vitamin supplements include methyl donors, molecules that form the methyl groups that become these genetic stop signs. Thin and brown weren't the only benefits the mice gained through methylation. The agouti gene in mice is linked to higher rates of diabetes and cancer. The mice with the switched-off agouti genes had significantly lower rates of cancer and diabetes than their parents. Of course, we've long understood the basic idea that good nutrition in an expectant mother is important for infant health. And we've also known that the connection goes beyond the obvious. Sufficient nutrition, healthy birth weight, and so forth, to reduce the likelihood of certain diseases later in life. But until the Duke study, the how was very unclear. As Dr. Randy Jertle, one of the leaders of the study, said, "We have long known that maternal nutrition profoundly impacts disease susceptibility in their offspring, but we never understood the cause and effect link. For the first time ever, we have shown precisely how nutritional supplementation to the mother can permanently alter gene expression in her offspring without altering the genes themselves." The impact of the Duke study was enormous, and the study of epigenetics has exploded since it was published. You can imagine why. First, epigenetics erased the conviction that genetic blueprints are written in indelible ink. Suddenly, science had to take into account the notion that a given set of genes is not an immutable set of blueprints or instructions. The exact same set of genes can produce different outcomes depending on which genes have undergone methylation and which have not. There was a whole new layer to consider, a set of reactions that acted outside and above the genetic code, changing its result without changing the code itself. That outside and above is where epigenetics gets its name, from the Greek prefix epi, meaning upon, after, or in addition. This shouldn't have been a complete surprise. For 50 years, some researchers have pointed out that the same genes don't always produce the same results. Identical twins, who share identical DNA, don't get the same diseases or fingerprints, just similar ones. Second, the Duke study snuggled right up to the ghost of Lamarck. Environmental factors in the life of the mother were shown to affect the inheritance of traits in her offspring. These factors didn't change the DNA the baby mice inherited, but in changing the way the DNA was expressed, they changed heredity. After those first mice experiments, other scientists at Duke showed that they could supercharge the brains of mice simply by adding a touch of choline to a pregnant mouse's diet. The choline triggered a methylation pattern that turned off the gene that normally acted to limit cell division in the memory center of the brain. With the cell division governor turned off, these mice started producing memory cells in high gear. And sure enough, they developed mighty mouse memories. Their neurons fired more rapidly and could fire more often. As adults, these mega-brain mice broke all the records in all the mazes. Researchers who study all kinds of animals, from mammals to reptiles to insects, have long noted the ability of some organisms to produce offspring that seem to be custom-tailored on the basis of the mother's experiences during pregnancy. They noted this ability, but they couldn't really explain it. Once scientists understood the possibility of epigenetic influence on heredity, it all made a lot more sense. The vole is a furry little rodent that looks something like a fat mouse. Depending upon the time of the year its mother is due to give birth, baby voles are born with either a thick coat or a thin coat. The gene for a thick coat is always there. It's just turned on or off depending on the level of light the mother senses in her environment around the time of conception. The developing genome basically gets a weather forecast before it has to go out into the world, so it knows what kind of coat it should grow. The mother of the tiny freshwater flea, Daphnia, which isn't really a flea at all, it's actually a crustacean, will produce offspring with a larger helmet and spines if it's going to give birth in an environment crowded with predators. The desert locust lives in two remarkably different styles, depending on the availability of food sources and the density of the local locust population. When food is scarce, as it usually is in their native desert habitat, locusts are born with coloring designed for camouflage and lead solitary lives. When rare periods of significant rain produce major vegetation growth, everything changes. At first, the locusts continue to be loners, just feasting off the abundant food supply. But as the extra vegetation starts to die off, the locusts find themselves crowded together. Suddenly, baby locusts are born with bright colors and a hankering for company. Instead of avoiding one another and hiding from predators through camouflage and inactivity, these locusts gather in swarms, feed together, and overwhelm their predators through sheer numbers. One species of lizard is born with a long tail and large body, or a small tail and small body, depending on one thing only, whether their mother smelled a lizard-eating snake while pregnant. When her babies are entering a snake-filled world, they're born with a long tail and big body, making them less likely to be snake food. In each of these cases, the vole, the water flea, the locust, and the lizard, the characteristics of offspring are controlled by epigenetic effects that occur during fetal development. The DNA doesn't change, but the way it's expressed does. This phenomenon, the mother's experiences influencing gene expression in her offspring, is called a predictive adaptive response, or maternal effect. Imagine the implications of this for humans. By sending the right epigenetic signals, we can have healthier, smarter, better adapted babies. As we learn more, we may be able to suppress the genes that express themselves in harmful ways even after birth, or turn helpful genes back on after they have been turned off. Epigenetics has the potential to give us a whole new measure of control over our health. DNA is destiny until you get out the old methyl magic marker and start rewriting it. The current focus in human epigenetics is on fetal development. it's now clear that the first few days after conception, when a mother may not even know she's pregnant, are even more critical than we've understood. That's when many important genes are switched on or off. And the earlier that epigenetic signals are transmitted, the more significant the potential changes are in the fetus. In some ways, the womb may be like a tiny evolutionary laboratory, examining new traits to see whether they'll help the fetus survive and thrive. If they won't, the mother miscarries. Researchers have certainly noted that many miscarried fetuses have genetic abnormalities. Here's how epigenetics may be partially responsible for the epidemic of childhood obesity. The junk food that fills so many American diets is high in calories and fats, but often very low in nutrients, especially those that are important to a developing embryo. If a newly pregnant mother spends the first weeks of her pregnancy eating a typical junk food-laden diet, the embryo may receive signals that it's going to be born into a harsh environment where critical types of food are scarce. Through a combination of epigenetic effects, various genes are turned on and off, and the baby is born small, so it needs less food to survive. But that's only half the story. Almost 20 years ago, a British medical professor named David Barker, who won the Danone International Prize for Nutrition in 2005, first suggested a link between poor fetal nutrition and later obesity. His theory, known as the Barker hypothesis, or the thrifty phenotype hypothesis, has been gaining ground ever since. Phenotype is the physical expression of your genotype. In other words, if you have one parent with attached earlobes and the other parent with detached earlobes, you will have detached earlobes because that trait is dominant. Detached earlobes would be part of your phenotype. Epigenetic effects influence your phenotype without changing your genotype. So in this hypothetical example, if a methyl marker turned off your gene for detached earlobes, your phenotype would change, you'd have attached earlobes, but your genotype would remain the same. You'd still have the gene for detached earlobes to pass on to your children. It would just be deactivated in you. According to the thrifty phenotype hypothesis, fetuses that experience poor nutrition develop thrifty metabolisms that are much more efficient at hoarding energy. When a baby with a thrifty phenotype was born 10,000 years ago during a time of relative famine, its conservationist metabolism helped it survive. When a baby with a thrifty metabolism is born in the 21st century surrounded by abundant food, that is also often nutritionally poor but calorie-rich, it gets fat. Epigenetics makes the thrifty phenotype hypothesis even more compelling because it helps us to understand how a mother's eating habits could affect the metabolic makeup of her children. If you're thinking about having a baby, you're probably already asking yourself what you should eat and when during your pregnancy. We don't know enough yet to understand exactly when human fetuses reach epigenetic trigger points, but animal studies suggest the process starts very early. One recent study of rats showed that when pregnant rats were fed a low-protein diet for just the first 4 days of pregnancy, before the embryo had even implanted in the uterus, their babies were prone to high blood pressure. Experiments with sheep showed similar maternal effects. Pregnant sheep that were underfed during the early days of pregnancy, again, even before the embryo implanted in the mother's uterus, gave birth to offspring that rapidly developed thickened arteries because their slower metabolisms stored more food as fat. How do we know these are adaptive responses, as opposed to birth defects resulting from the mother's poor nutrition? Because the health problems, thickened arteries and increased weight, only occur when the baby sheep were provided with normal diets. Baby sheep whose mothers were undernourished while pregnant showed no sign of arterial thickening when they were also undernourished as toddlers. Most of the epigenetic effects currently under study involve mothers, not fathers. In part, that's because an embryo or fetus never interacts with its father's environment. So many scientists believed epigenetic modifications only occurred after conception, in response to information the fetus received about the mother's environment. However, there is new and intriguing evidence that fathers can pass information to their offspring as well. A British study found that men who started to smoke before puberty had sons who were significantly fatter than normal by the time they were 9. This correlation was found only in sons. So scientists think these epigenetic markers are passed on the Y chromosome. Intuitively, you might expect the children of smoking fathers to be smaller, not fatter. It's possible that this effect is analogous to the thrifty phenotype, in which poor maternal nutrition in the early stages of pregnancy leads to the birth of small babies with thrifty metabolisms who have a high tendency to become fat. In this case, there may be an epigenetic change in the father's sperm triggered by the toxins in the smoke the father is inhaling. Those toxins would indicate a difficult environment, so the sperm is ready to create a baby with a thrifty metabolism. And when that thrifty metabolism is combined with a typical Western diet, the likelihood of that baby growing up to be a fat child dramatically increases. The lead scientist on the study, Marcus Pembrey, a British geneticist, believes this proves the existence of paternal effects in addition to maternal effects. He called this proof of principle. The sperm have captured information about the ancestral environment, and this is modifying the development and health of subsequent generations. This lends a whole new meaning to sons paying for the sins of their fathers. Mom and dad may not be the only epigenetic influences in your life. Grandpa and grandma may be reaching down from their perch above you in the family, leaving their own marks. That's certainly what many of the most prominent epigenetic researchers, from the authors of the fat yellow mice study at Duke to the researchers behind the Smoking Fathers Report in London, think. They all believe that epigenetic changes can be passed through the germline for many generations. In the case of maternal inheritance, the opportunity for your ultimate genotype to get a methyl markup in your grandmother is actually very direct. When a human female is born, she already has the complete set of eggs she will have for life in her baby ovaries. As strange as it sounds, that means that the egg you developed from, with half of your chromosomes, was created in your mother's ovaries while she was still in your grandmother's womb. And new research demonstrates that when your grandmother passed epigenetic signals to your mother, she was also passing those signals to the egg that would eventually provide half of your DNA. Just as epigenetics has helped to unlock the mystery of thin-coated voles and sociable locusts, it's now helping to explain a series of confusing correlations researchers have gathered over the last century. A group of researchers in Los Angeles found that children whose grandmothers smoked while pregnant were more likely to have asthma than children whose mothers smoked while pregnant. Before we started to crack the epigenetic code, this correlation was impossible to explain. Now scientists realize that the smoking grandmother triggered an epigenetic effect in her fetal daughter's supply of eggs. Incidentally, if you're puzzled as to why the grandmother's smoking habits affected their eggs more than their fetuses, you're not alone. Scientists haven't figured that out yet. A harsh winter and a cruel embargo imposed by the Nazis combined to cause the Dutch famine of 1944 and 1945. 30,000 people died during the Hunger Winter, or Hongerwinter, as the Dutch call it. An examination of birth records following the famine is one of the ways Barker confirmed his thrifty phenotype hypothesis. Women who were in the first 6 months of pregnancy during the Hongerwinter gave birth to small babies who grew up to be more prone to obesity, coronary disease, and a variety of cancers. Although the results are still controversial, researchers reported an even bigger surprise around 20 years later when their studies indicated that the grandchildren of those women were also born with low birth weights. Is it possible that the methyl markers triggered by poor nutrition during the famine were passed on to the next generation? That's not known yet, but the effects of methylation, it seems, are real. Many leading epigenetic scholars think epigenetic changes represent evolution's subtle effort to tweak an existing genome, although that's still quite contentious. The scientists at Duke who published the mouse study wrote, Our findings show that early nutrition can influence the establishment of epigenetic marks that affect all tissues, including, presumably, the germline. Hence, incomplete erasure of nutritionally induced epigenetic alterations provides a plausible mechanism by which adaptive evolution may occur in mammals. In other words, when methyl markers aren't erased, they can be passed on generation after generation, ultimately leading to evolution. Or in other words, traits acquired by a parent or grandparent can ultimately be inherited by his or her descendants. Lamarck must be turning in his grave. The theory that he didn't come up with is on the verge of becoming all the rage. Marcus Pembry, the scientist behind the parental smoking study, calls himself a neo-Lamarckian. And Douglas Rudin, a researcher at the University of Alabama, told a reporter from The Scientist, "Epigenetics has always been Lamarckian. I really don't think there's any controversy." Most of the methyl effects we've talked about so far involve changes that take place before birth. But epigenetic changes occur throughout life, as the placement of methyl markers turns some genes off, and the removal of methyl markers turns other genes back on. In 2004, Michael Meany, a professor at McGill University in Canada, published a report that caused nearly as big a sensation as the Duke report about yellow and brown mice. Meany's study showed that the interaction between mothers and their offspring after birth provoked the placement of methyl markers that caused significant epigenetic changes. Meany studied the behavior of rats that received different levels of attention from their mothers in the first few hours after birth. Pups that were gently licked by their mothers grew into confident rat babies that were relatively relaxed and could handle stressful situations. But rats that were ignored by their mothers grew to be nervous wrecks. Now this sounds like an experiment ripe for a nature versus nurture debate, doesn't it? Those on the nature side would argue that rat moms with bad social skills passed on their emotionally troubled genes to rat babies that grew up to have bad social skills, while the well-adjusted rats gave their babies well-adjusted genes. That makes sense as far as it goes, except that Meany and his colleagues pulled a mate and switch. They gave babies from standoffish mothers to loving mothers, and vice versa. Pups that were fawned over grew to be calm regardless of their natural mother's behavior. Are all you nurture advocates out there smelling victory? If rats that were treated well turned out well regardless of their genetic makeup, then that means their personalities developed in response to their parenting. Score one for Mother Nature. Not so fast. An analysis of the rats' genes showed striking differences in methylation patterns between the two sets of rats. Rat pups that were attentively groomed by their mothers, biological or adopted, showed a decrease in methyl markers around the genes involved with brain development. The mother's gentle attention somehow triggered the removal of methyl markers that would otherwise have blocked or impeded the development of a part of their baby's brains, almost as if they were licking them off. The part of the brain that dampened the stress response was more developed in those babies. This wasn't nature versus nurture. This was nature and nurture. Meany's paper was another epigenetic blockbuster. Something as simple as parental grooming was changing the expression of a living animal's genetic code. The notion was so shocking that some people had a hard time accepting it. One reviewer at a prominent journal actually went so far as to write that, despite the researcher's carefully marshaled evidence, he refused to believe it could be true. It just wasn't supposed to happen like that. But it does. We don't really know for sure whether parental care for human infants has the same kind of effect on the development of human brains. In one sense, though, it doesn't matter, because we already know that parent-child bonds from birth through early childhood have a profound impact on emotional development. We know that the emotional state of loving, responsive parents gets passed on to their children in a kind of mental methylation, and so does anything that increases a parent's anxiety. Everything from a dissolving marriage to health problems to financial trouble can raise the stress of a new parent and interfere with a child-parent relationship. Children whose parents are overly stressed are more prone to depression and have less self-control. Children whose parents are relaxed and available tend to be happier and healthier. And while we don't know whether neonatal parenting is actually changing brain development, scientists who study this epigenetic connection in animals believe it's very unlikely that humans don't share it. In fact, the total picture suggests humans should be more prone to epigenetic effects in infancy. After all, cognitive development and physical development after birth in humans are much more significant than they are in most other mammals. Like mutation, methylation is neither good nor bad on its own. It all depends on what genes are being turned on and what genes are being turned off and for what reason. Good nutrition in pregnant mice led to the addition of methyl markers on the agouti gene that freed a generation of baby mice from a fat yellow future. Parental grooming in rats provoked the removal of methyl markers around genes responsible for brain development. The same thing is true in humans. Some genes are better turned off, and there are other genes that we want on duty 24/7. Methylation also doesn't always just turn a gene completely off. Genes can be partially methylated, and the degree of methylation correlates to how active the gene remains. The less methylation, the more active it is. One set of genes that we want always on guard are those that suppress tumors and repair DNA. Those genes are the stormtroopers and flight surgeons of the anti-cancer corps. Scientists have identified dozens of these genetic guardians. When they're shut down, cancer cells have free rein. A recent article in Science News told the story of two identical twins, Elizabeth and Eleanor, not their real names, born on November 19, 1939. From the moment they were born, they were treated the same because their mother never wanted either girl to feel she was more or less favored. Elizabeth said, "We were treated like a unit, more like one person instead of two separate individuals." They moved apart more than 40 years ago in their early 20s, but they're still very similar. From the way they look to the things they care about, it's clear that they're identical twins, with one big exception. 7 years ago, Eleanor was diagnosed with breast cancer. Elizabeth has never been. Identical twins share the same exact DNA, but DNA isn't fate. And one of the reasons is methylation. It's possible that 40-plus years of exposure to a different environment produced a different methylation pattern around Eleanor's genes, a pattern that unfortunately may have led to breast cancer. In 2005, Manuel Esteller of the Spanish National Cancer Center, along with colleagues, issued a report showing that identical twins shared almost identical methylation patterns at birth, that diverged as they grew older. And the report indicated that those patterns diverged much more dramatically when the twins lived apart for most of their lives, just as Eleanor and Elizabeth have. Esteller said, "We believe these different epigenetic patterns in twins depend many times on the environment, whether it's exposure to different chemical agents, diets, smoke, or whether people live in a big city or the countryside." There's more evidence coming in to support the idea that methylation of specific genes is tightly connected to cancer. In Germany, scientists at a company called Epigenomics have reported an overwhelming connection between breast cancer recurrence and the amount of methylation of a gene called PITX2. 90% of the women with low methylation of the PITX2 gene were cancer-free after 10 years. While only 65% of the women with high methylation were as lucky. Ultimately, this kind of information will help doctors to custom tailor cancer treatments. The more help they can get from the body's natural cancer fighters, the less aggressive they may need to be in terms of chemotherapy and radiation. The data from epigenomics is already being used to help women who have low methylation of PITX2 decide if chemotherapy is necessary after their tumor is removed. Scientists are establishing clear links between methylation of cancer-fighting genes and cancer-causing behavior. Over time, habits like smoking can cause a massive buildup of methyl markers around these genes. Scientists call this hypermethylation. People who smoke exhibit hypermethylation around genes that would otherwise combat lung cancer. Genes that are supposed to fight prostate cancer are hypermethylated in smokers too. In part because of the hypermethylating effect of potentially carcinogenic habits, methylation patterns can also be an early warning signal. In India, millions of people are addicted to betel nuts, a peppery seed that stains the teeth and gums red when it's chewed, and, like nicotine, is mildly intoxicating, highly addictive, and seriously carcinogenic. Because of betel nut chewing, oral cancer is the most common cancer in Indian men. And because oral cancer often doesn't manifest any symptoms for a long time, it's often fatal. 70% of the people diagnosed with oral cancer in India eventually die of it. A lifetime of betel nut chewing can lead to hypermethylation of three cancer-fighting genes, one that suppresses tumors, one that repairs DNA, and one that hunts out lone cancer cells and gets them to self-destruct. Reliance Life Sciences, the Indian company that established this link, has developed a test to measure the degree of methylation in these genes. We'd like to use the degree of methylation at sites near these three genes as a predictive marker to qualitatively say how far a person is from developing oral cancer, said Dr. Dhananjaya Saranath, one of the scientists at Reliance Life Sciences. Ultimately, tests like this could be an enormous tool in measuring cancer risk, leading to much earlier diagnosis and much higher survival rates. Right now, epigenetics is in a bit of a the more we know, the less we understand phase. One thing is clear. It seems pretty certain that things we know to be bad for us can end up being bad for our descendants, as epigenetic markers get passed on from generation to generation. So smoking two packs a day and living a supersized life may actually make your children, and even their children, more prone to disease. But what about using methyl markers to have a positive influence on our kids? Folic acid and B12 worked for mice. Will it work for humans? If your family's had a bit of a weight problem as far back as you can remember, can a few methyl markers prevent that heritage from weighing your baby down? The truth is, we just don't know. And we don't even know everything we don't know yet. Here's the first thing we don't know. We don't have anywhere near a complete understanding of which genes are turned off or turned down by which methyl donors. For example, methylation of a gene that influences hair color might lead to a harmless change. But the same process that triggered methylation of the hair color gene may also be suppressing a tumor suppressor. To complicate things further, methyl stop signs often land near transposons, those jumping genes. When that transposon inserts itself somewhere else in the genome, it may carry methyl markers with it, where they may attach themselves to another gene, muting its expression, or at least turning down the volume. In fact, the authors of the Duke study were so impressed by the enormous range of potential epigenetic effects that they issued a word of caution to anyone interested in applying the results of their research to humans. These findings suggest that dietary supplementation, long presumed to be purely beneficial, may have unintended deleterious influences on the establishment of epigenetic gene regulation in humans. In other words, we don't really know everything that's going on here, folks. To be clear, if you're getting ready to have a baby, this isn't to suggest that you throw out the container of vitamins your doctor prescribed. These vitamins have a lot to recommend them, As we mentioned a few chapters ago, folic acid is very important during pregnancy. Study after study has shown that folic acid supplements reduce birth defects that can cause damage to a developing brain or spinal cord. The connection is so strong that the government required grains to be fortified with folic acid, much as drinking water is fortified with fluoride. And there's been a corresponding decrease in diseases, such as spina bifida, that are related to folic acid deficiency in pregnant women. That's a wonderful thing, but it may not be the whole story. Our understanding of epigenetics is so immature, we have to be wary about unintended consequences. We just don't know what other genes may be influenced by pumping methyl donors into the food supply, and we probably won't know for years. When doctors expect a pregnant woman to give birth prematurely, she is often injected with a drug, usually betamethasone, to help speed up the development of her fetus's lungs, dramatically improving its chance of survival. Now, there are signs that children whose mothers received multiple doses of betamethasone have increased levels of hyperactivity and slower than normal overall growth. A recent University of Toronto study demonstrated that these effects may continue for multiple generations. The leader of the study believes the betamethasone causes epigenetic changes in the fetus that are passed on to its own offspring in turn. One doctor who specializes in treating premature babies said the study was terrifying beyond comprehension. Vitamins and drugs that cause methylation, in addition to fulfilling their primary purpose, are just the beginning. Now we're starting to see drugs actually designed to affect methylation patterns. The first of these drugs was approved by the Food and Drug Administration in 2004. Called azacitidine in its generic form, it was hailed as a breakthrough for the treatment of myelodysplastic syndrome, or MDS. MDS is a very difficult-to-treat collection of blood disorders that often lead to potentially deadly leukemia.